Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Democracy is sweeping across the Middle East and North Africa. Or is it? Is this just smoke and mirrors as the West topples a few regimes who stand in the way of their goal, an attack on Iran? Mubarak has gone, but has Egypt just been through a revolution? Or a military coup? Propaganda about Libyan leader Colonel Gaddafi ordering the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher and the Lockerbie bombing is all over our newspapers and TV again. And regime change, even an invasion of Libya, is on the cards. But no need for regime change in Bahrain, where the US Fifth Fleet is anchored, despite continued protests there. We take a tour of the region with two of Bristol's Middle Eastern expats. Libyan-born Mohamed Al-Haddad tells us how Libya's troubles began with a mob of drunken football fans. And Palestinian journalist Iqbal Tamimi has been monitoring the Arab language news. So first, to Egypt. Now, Martin Summers, maybe you can just start here, help us out. Just explain, can you, what led up to the fact that this old chap Mubarak, 80 years old, is actually in this position for such a long time? Is he just a sort of tin pot dictator? How did he get there?
Well, he took over when Sadat was assassinated. I can't remember when Sadat was assassinated. It was 79, was it?
82, I guess.
And he was the vice president, and then he took over. Basically, he's led Egypt back into the US camp at a point, you know, because in the 50s, Egypt was in a sort of revolutionary camp, if you like. Nasser was in charge. They nationalised the Suez Canal. He kicked the British out and basically got in bed with the Soviets. But Mubarak led the country back in the opposite direction under the US umbrella, as it were. And he's been in power ever since, backed up by the West.
Now, Iqbal Tamimi, before you give us your ideas of what's been going on in Egypt, can you just tell us a bit about your history and how you came to be in Bristol?
Well, I worked 17 years in the media in the Middle East, and as you know, I'm Palestinian. I can't go back home. And I was working in Dubai. I was a victim of a stabbing accident. I'm not sure if it's called accident or not, but I ended up in UK and here I am.
So what were you actually doing over there? Were you working in television?
I worked in television. I worked in broadcasting, print and blogging media.
Okay.
I've been around, most of my time was in TV production for the news.
Whereabouts?
I worked at Al Arabiya TV station, at the NBC station, and at the Sharjah TV.
Okay, well. And in which countries are those? Just in Palestine? Or
no, those are in the United Arab Emirates.
Okay, and can you give us an idea? Because a lot of countries, and a lot of, I mean, where, what is the United Arab Emirates like as a country? Is it ruled by a king, or is it one of these little dictators, or is it a democracy, or what?
Most Gulf states have their own kind of, let's say that sheikhs are ruling, families are ruling. They don't have a constitution of, there is no elections. You don't choose your leader. There is no what you call a democratic system. And it's not totally like a monarchy, or it's different from, the governance of something like Egypt or any of the other Arab states that they had the revolution for different reasons.
So how did you find it actually working in television over there? Was it different to the sort of media we have here?
Well, every media is totally different because you have different policies of censorship. For example, you have issues which they call red line, you don't talk about, you try to avoid. It depends on who is supporting your TV station and who's sponsoring your programs, as in all media, as you know. And this is why I think the new media or the internet has brought this kind of change all over the world. The citizen media is the real media right now.
Now, one of the stations that we can pick up over here is, of course, is the English version of Al Jazeera. Do you think that's a typical Arab and Gulf state station? I think that's based in Qatar, isn't it?
It is based in Qatar, but it's totally different from Arab media. In general, when Al Jazeera Arabic version started, it was helped or sponsored by some Qatari money, but they claim that Qatar had no influence on Al Jazeera, even though I think not, because when things happen, sensitive things about, for example, Qatar-Israeli relationships, they don't talk about it in Al Jazeera. In general, I find that Al Jazeera English is very professional, and there is a minute difference between Al Jazeera Arabic and Al Jazeera English, maybe because the staff are different or their backgrounds of, you know, experience is different of how to handle the news. There is a minute difference.
Leaving Al Jazeera aside for a minute, is there much difference between the sort of news that you can get if you're an Arabic speaker out there on the internet or on the satellite?
Definitely, because the news we get in English are the news that is sort of sponsored or cared for by mainstream media or big institutions or establishments who can invite somebody who speaks English or who can have the money or the budget for a translator, while you get all the important issues direct from the average person in Arabic online, maybe through interviews, from blogging, from all kind of new media. If you really know how to handle searching on Google's engine in Arabic, you can find a large amount of filming material sent by people through their mobile phones. You can read even poems with sarcasm. You can read stories. You can see even photos, pictures taken by ordinary citizens during the revolution. Everything.
Well, one of the things I noticed, of course, was whilst there was all these protests going on in Tahrir Square in Cairo, almost all of the banners were in Arabic, and you couldn't. We as English people couldn't understand them. Do you think that there's actually something much more that you can get as an Arabic speaker
Many things. Even as an Arab, every area of the Arab world have their own sense of humor and their own, let's say, vocabulary that means something. And it's connected with their history, with their past, with their everyday living. And if you understand these words, which are connected to politics and otherwise, symbolism and otherwise, you can see, you can read what is going on the streets. When I used to watch, for example, the news in English, I thought, well, this is superficial. This is, just like reading the titles. But what's behind, there is a large sum of information going on in Arabic that the media is missing on.
So can you give us an idea of some of the things that were going on, and even humorous things, in Tahrir Square as Mubarak was being slowly toppled?
I am a poet, so I love words. I love words. And I was looking for photos that came through the email from different colleagues and from different websites about the different placards, that were written by ordinary citizens. One of them I liked very much. One of them was by a carpenter. He says, "We, the carpenters of Egypt, the Union of Carpenters, we are asking Mr. Mubarak if he can please tell us what kind of glue he was using to stick himself to stay on his chair for such a long time. We want to use it." And another person says that, "I've been married only for 14 days and I miss my wife. I miss my bride. Please go away, Mubarak. I want to go home." Another person says, my wife is giving birth. She's having labor pains and my child doesn't want to see you. Go so that he can come to life." So there is a lot of things that were really humorous. Even people, their actions, a number of barbers started their own shop in the middle of the Tahrir Square for free. They are cutting hair and shaving people for free because they think that they are participating in the revolution. And a couple made their wedding ceremony in the middle of the Tahrir Square. So they are lively, peaceful people. There are lots of beautiful photos about Christians guarding the Muslims while they are kneeling in prayer on Fridays, because the community in Egypt is extremely, extremely loving kind of community. And when the Christians were going to Sunday mass prayers and the Muslims were guarding the doors of the church, this is a beautiful. One of the Islamists said that I kneeled on the ground to pray, because when they said Mubarak is out, and my next door neighbor kneeled like Muslims do with me, he kneeled with me. So it was a kind of solidarity that the people feel proud about, because it's not about age or gender. I mean, women, I have never seen such a large number of women on the streets with their children, some of them breastfeeding. They took their children, and the first lady who's the first call for this kind of revolution was a woman. She started a group online on Facebook, and from there she was filming every day from her home and sending on YouTube, asking people to get on the streets and do something about their lives. And they just went down. And I've seen many of the artists I used to know and the actors involved with the people and saying what they are thinking about. I've heard lots of poets. I've seen lots of intellectuals telling what they are. It's nice to break down the barrier of silence.
Now, what about Tunisia? Because that's quite a different country, isn't it? It's slightly more westernized, I believe, than Egypt.
It is different, and nobody thought that it will break that fast. But the system is totally, as I told you, it's different from Egypt. And people didn't know much about it as much as we knew about Egypt. Egypt, because of, you know, it's a bigger country, they have 80 plus million people, and because of its relationships with Israel and their policies with the USA, had more coverage than Tunisia. But also, as I've forwarded to my friends some of the clips I have found in Arabic about what they have found in the palace of Zine El Abidine after he left. I mean, you can't imagine the amount of money and jewelry he's been stacking in his palaces while people were dying of hunger. And this is ridiculous. And now you can understand why people would burn themselves to death, because they lost everything. They just. Desperate, they are desperate, and they made it.
What about Bahrain then? Because this is again, it's one of these Gulf states, which is rather different to these bigger countries like Tunisia and Egypt and Libya, of course. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because certainly seems to be a bit more westernized again, but still it has this kind of dynasty. It's very much a sort of oil state and money state, Bahrain. And obviously the other problem for the Bahraini people is that they've got a massive US fleet based there.
I can assure you, after the revolution, all the Arab leaders now know that they can't rely at all on USA or its help. They found out the hard way that when somebody falls, all the knives will be out. It happened. I mean, nobody was as they call it, the slave of USA as much as Mubarak. And when he fallen down, nobody dared to phone him and say, how are you doing? And why don't you come as a guest and stay with us? The thing in Bahrain is different, because along its whole history, it didn't have problems as much as, let's say, what was going on in Egypt or other areas. And it is a wealthy country, and besides, it's very small in size. The Western media is trying to say that the problem is caused partially by the differences between Shiite and Sunni Muslims, because of the composition, because the leadership is Sunni and the majority of the population are Shiite. It's not that. It's between the elites who are having all the money and the wealth, and the rest of the people who have very little. And there is a lot of corruption all over the Arab world. I can't tell you that there is one Arab world, one Arab country that does not have corruption, but on different levels. But even the ones who are stable, or they claim to be most democratic now, are frightened to death. Even some wealthy countries in the Gulf are offering money for its people, for every single person in their country. Like Saudi Arabia now is offering money and promising to look into the constitution and reform. Kuwait is the same. The Kuwait is considered the most democratic in the Arab countries because they have they can say what they want and they have election system and everything. Every single leader in the Arab world now is promising reform. And we, I think we, when you talked about the introduction, you said something about Iran. I don't think it's Iran is different. They are going to have the same thing because people are boiling over there because of corruption and because of oppression. Of they want to speak up their minds.
Martin Summers is with us here too. Martin, what are your thoughts first of all then about you know what's where this is all headed now? Because we've had several topplings of governments. To what extent is this a really spontaneous uprising, and to what extent is it something else going on? Obviously, this is a very oil-rich region, and there's a lot of particularly the markets are very very powerful, and they're looking at this region saying, "Well, we want to make sure our oil supply is secure."
Well, it is. I mean, obviously, it isn't secure. The oil price is rising as we speak. They're mainly scared about Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the main influence on the oil price, and so the uprising in Libya has made the markets panicked about Saudi Arabia. They're not so bothered about Libya, but Saudi Arabia, they're really bothered about that.
One thing that bothers me is that when this kind of thing starts to happen, then the West starts to think it's time to intervene.
Well, they've been intervening all the way. I mean, the West has basically been dominating this region. I mean, Bahrain, for example, only got independence from Britain in 1971. It used to be a British colony until 1971, and the Bahraini royal family were put in power by British gunboats 200 years ago. They weren't, in fact, from Bahrain. They were a sort of pirate clan, and they tried to establish themselves in various parts of the Gulf and eventually settled on Bahrain. And the British created all of these monarchies because they didn't want... They wanted lots of small monarchies which would be dominated by the British, and then the Americans have taken over where the British left off. And I think there is going to be changes everywhere, including Iran. There has to be. I mean, I think what's really positive about this is that these are universal values that people are standing up for. As Muslims and as Christians and as atheists.
I think even USA now, there are people rebelling against certain things. I think
indeed
that the people now are starting to say, that's enough. We want to say what we believe. We had enough of people using our resources and misuse the money of the country. It's the people everywhere. It has nothing to do with being Arab or non-Arab.
No, it's going to spread way outside the Middle East
exactly.
region, isn't it? It's a global
thing. The
thing
about, for example, the Libya, that until now, even though in the past it was the leader of Libya was considered as a dictator, they still dealt with him. And most Western countries dealt with him,
yep.
And they brought him back, thanks to Tony Blair. He gave him credibility, and he's back. And now, when they are talking about how to solve the problem, they are talking about sanctions. And I don't know if they will do the same problem or the same mistake they have done with the sanctions with Iraq, where the people who suffered were the nation. I mean, there must be some other kind of way of dealing with this without punishing collectively the people.
Well, that's going to have a look now at the oil side of all of this and the markets, the way that the markets are likely to influence what's going on in the Middle East, because there certainly is a Western hand involved in some of this. So are the oil companies and their financial backers actually involved? Investigative journalists who exposed the hanging chance voting fraud when George W. Bush was first elected in the US, his name is Greg Palast, and he was talking to Russia Today's Max Kaiser about the petro-dictatorship.
You're assuming that Mother Nature sets the price of oil. We have cartels. We have the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, which is an illegal cartel. It's a group of pirates, and Exxon and Chevron ride on their backs while they set the price of oil. Yeah, we've run out of $2 a barrel oil, but we're buying barrels of oil today at nearly $100 a barrel. Don't blame Mother Nature for a cartel monopolization of the oil. And by the way, oil is a very big part of the Egyptian story. I haven't heard much news about the fact that the biggest oil strike of the decade occurred in the Nile Delta in Egypt. That is a big, big part of the story. And the Egyptians know that that oil was struck. And what they want to know is, if we're now an oil nation, what happened to the money? Where did it go? And I can tell you, where do you think Mubarak got $70 billion? He didn't get it by, you know, selling linen shirts, which is their big export out of Egypt. It's the oil. And I haven't heard anyone talk about the oil story in this Egyptian eruption.
Well, yeah, the oil in Egypt is not a new story. In fact, it's a big part of the economy. And recently, they become an oil or energy importer as opposed to an exporter, coinciding with these riots. So the Egypt story, they're out of oil. And the price discovery mechanism, you talk about $100 oil, what about $200, $300, $400 a barrel oil is what we're talking about, because there's simply no more oil. You know, you've run out of oil. The GAWAR in Saudi Arabia is running out of oil. Canarel is running out of oil in Mexico. Bergen in Kuwait, they're running out of oil. This is the oil's gone. So this is why people are rioting, because the food and the oil are now disappearing, and there's no plan B. What I'm saying is, these governments are going to go out of business by their own short-sightedness anyway, because the oil's gone.
I don't see oil being gone. Our $100 barrel price has nothing to do with oil being gone. I don't know of a single place on the planet right now that's pulling up oil that costs $100 a barrel to pull up, or $50 a barrel to pull up. In fact, the most expensive reserves being pulled up right now are in Venezuela, the heavy, super heavy oil at $30 a barrel, and the Canada tar sands, which is about $28 a barrel. The price of oil today is not in any way affected by its supply. There is just no connection. It is a monopoly. We've allowed basically our oil companies to wink and nod and take part in a cartel, which is holding oil off the market. I can tell you, for example, a massive find in the Caspian Sea, where I just was. Yet, when the Soviet Union pulled out and the wall fell and Azerbaijan became an independent nation, and Azerbaijan, by the way, used to provide 50% of the world's oil, and it can again. The thing is that production actually dropped like a bomb, even though it was being run by British Petroleum. The reason was is that when oil was cheap, they simply shut off the spigots. That's very important. And let's not forget that we also lost a lot of oil because we bombed the hell out of the Iraqi fields. That cut off the price of oil. So whatever Mother Nature is doing or not, however much there is in the ground, we are now under a petro-dictatorship. We have to get off the oil, because otherwise they have the whip hand on us.
That was Greg Palast there speaking to Max Keiser on Russia Today. Martin, can you just try and clear this up between the two of them? They're arguing there. Is it to do with the oil running out, or is it just that the prices are being fixed? It's causing
Oil obviously will run out in the end, but I think that Greg Palast is right that the price is being fixed. And another thing that he didn't mention, of course, is that there's been a deregulation of commodity futures markets. So, in fact, something like the Libyan uprising means that it's a one-way bet if you're buying oil, and it's a bubble, basically. You force the price up. Profiteering is taking place, and people are profiteering on the back of people's misery. So all of this, all of the fighting and the dying pushes the oil price up. The speculators pile in. They're literally making a killing. And these futures markets were deregulated a few years ago. So everything is being rigged behind the scenes by wealthy people. Pretty people in the streets in the Middle East know very well how it works.
Is that true, Iqbal? Do you think that's the case, that this is a lot of this is related to the economics of oil?
I don't understand it very well, because as far as I know from research, that USA, for example, has never used its reserve. It buys all the oil that is coming from the Gulf area and from Arab countries. And regardless of that, all the money that came back, let's say, for Libya, let's say, where has it gone? I mean, if you look at the revenues of oil, there is a big gap between the revenues of oil and what is really found in Libya. And you ask where that gone? It's because Gaddafi was buying and contributing to some kind of political activities in Africa. And he was supporting Mugabe, and he was supporting the Zagawa tribe in Darfur. So where he would buy the arms. Certainly, from those revenues of oil are going back through buying arms from USA or from UK or whatever, because even the canisters or the, you know, the gas canisters they found on the streets were made in USA and some made in UK, in Tunisia, in Egypt, and in Libya. So it's at the very end, regardless of the cycle, the oil prices are coming back to where they came. I mean, whoever paid for the oil is selling them back through arms, through arm deals.
That's right. Yeah, so they then sell them arms, which is so they
and, oil, and at yeah. the end, a liter of blood is much cheaper than a liter of oil.
Yeah.
Now, what are your thoughts? We did mention this in the first hour, Iqbal, about David Cameron's trip that he's just made to the Middle East in order to help sell arms to these Middle Eastern countries. Do you think that's a bit of an inappropriate time for him to be doing this or not?
I think selling arms at any time is an inappropriate. At the moment, I mean, if you, for example, look at Egypt and investigate how people were really suffering poverty and you read a little bit or watch films about the elites who used to, benefit from the people's money, you go wild. I mean, one of the reasons why the Egyptians were mad is because Mubarak was selling their gas for less than one third of its production price to Israel, while the ordinary Egyptian person who is on the brink of poverty is paying the full price. Why is that? Such policies are controlled through USA, and it's not just a small game. But as I said before, he was their puppy, their little puppy, and he obeyed the rules. But when he was knocked over, nobody said, stretch your hand to pull him up. And this is what is frightening at the moment.
Before we leave Egypt, what are your thoughts about whether this is a genuine revolution or whether it's just been a military coup? Because the military are now in charge, aren't they?
No, the military did not even interfere. The military were just watching, and I would claim that they were happy with what was happening. The people had enough, and I mean, the Egyptian army are from the nation, and they have their a reputation to protect, and they wouldn't shoot back at their own people. Exactly what is happening in Libya. They are ordered to shoot at their own families and people, and people deflecting. They are leaving the army because it's not worthy of the cause. And I think it is 100% genuine, and people are on their way. I mean, they might face a little bit of struggle regarding reorganizing themselves and reestablishing the proper institutions and democratic procedures and all that, but they will do it because there are educated people who were suppressed for such a long time, and there are skilled people who can run the country properly.
Right, well, on to talking about Libya now. And back on the 17th of April 1984, there was a masked demonstration outside London's Libyan embassy in St James's Square. Shots rang out across the square that afternoon, and a policewoman, Yvonne Fletcher, was fatally wounded. It later transpired the demonstrators were what's known in the trade as a counter gang, run and paid for by the American intelligence service, the CIA. A two-part dispatches documentary aired on the 10th and the 17th of April 1996, 12 years later. And it was entitled Murder in St James. It went back over what proved to be a flawed inquest into Yvonne's death and proved that the single shot that killed her could not have been fired from the Libyan embassy.
If you take the original of the single bullet, it's much louder and it just seems more dense, it sounds more dense. Whereas the machine gun is, rat-a-tat-tat. And isn't as loud. And
so this is a denser, louder sound.
It's a denser, louder sound, yes.
Now, given that we've got a two-second gap here, and the gaps between the bullets, the rat-a-tat-tat of the automatic weapon on the student tape are a tenth of a second, can these two be related?
No, they're not related at all. No. This is a separate shot entirely. It suggests that there's another weapon. It suggests that there is either a handgun or something, another gun.
Firing a single shot.
This all suggests that whoever fired the bullet which killed WPC Fletcher was able to use the submachine gun fire from the embassy as cover. In the confusion, no one spotted the fatal 12th bullet fired from the top of a building nearby. Across the square at number 3, the top two floors were fully occupied by a British company, Distillers. Not so the 6th floor. This empty office space had some very unofficial tenants. The British security services had used it for weeks to watch the Libyans. But on the day of the demonstration, the pattern suddenly changed.
Were they in the building on the day, on April the 17th, 1984?
No, definitely not.
So that floor number 6 was just vacant? It was just
that
empty.
Floor would have been vacant still.
If the killer did fire from number 3, there was a quick and easy escape route. With all eyes focused on the square, he could have been down these back stairs and into a quiet side street in under a minute. But who was he, and who set him up to do it? The trail of Yvonne Fletcher's killer was to take us far from St. James's Square, to a world where sex, drugs and guns are the currency of daily business. In one of Europe's crime capitals, we found ruthless men who know well the name of Yvonne Fletcher. What's more, they know exactly how and why she died. Next week, dispatches will unmask them and lay bare their guilty secret.
That was an extract from a dispatches programme which aired on the 10th of April 1996, reflecting on the death of PC Yvonne Fletcher, 17th of April 1984, and really saying that there's no way that she could have been shot from the Libyan embassy, looking at the trajectory of where the bullet came from. Now, Martin, why is it that something like this may have been so sort of set up, as it were, from making it look as if there was a burst of machine gun fire into the air from the Libyan embassy when Yvonne Fletcher died, and then one single bullet from a neighbouring building?
Yeah, well, the British intelligence services were bugging the embassy, so they knew that the Libyans were intending to open fire as a warning to the demonstrators, and they used that as a cover for themselves to shoot WPC Yvonne Fletcher. That's the thesis of the dispatches documentaries. Libya at that stage, you've got to remember, the Reagan administration in the US was trying to create an enemy in the Middle East. So, you know, in the subsequent years, they created Al-Qaeda, they created Osama bin Laden, people like this to be the bogeyman. But they wanted Libya to be the bogeyman. So, of course, killing a 19-year-old police woman was a way to get the British public angry and on side with, we're going to attack Libya.
And it led to the UN imposing sanctions on Libya.
It did, and it also led to another thing that happened, of course, was the so-called, when Libya got bombed, if you remember, subsequent to this, there was supposedly a bomb in a discotheque in Berlin which killed two US Marines, I think it was, and that was blamed on Libya. But in Viktor Ostrovsky's book, who was a Mossad agent, he said no, Mossad went into Libya and sent out a supposed message to a team in Berlin to carry out this bombing, which of course then led to the bombing of Libya, killed 100 people, including Gaddafi's daughter. Again, the suggestion is that this was all Libya being set up. And I noticed that one of the ministers who's defected from the Libyan government is saying he's got proof that Gaddafi ordered the Lockerbie bombing. Now, I think that may be him just telling people what he thinks they want to hear.
Yesterday's front page of The Sun, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. But at the same time, we know that there was about to be an appeal for Megrahi in the Scottish the highest level in Scotland, and he was probably going to get off because a Scottish police inspector, who hasn't been named, was willing to testify that the CIA had planted the circuit board which linked the Libyans to the bombing. And also, things I've read on the internet point out quite straightforwardly, you won't find a circuit board from a bomb. Why would you? It'll be vaporised.
Well, if anyone wants to look further at that, there's a documentary called The Maltese Double Cross.
Yeah, by Frankovic.
By Alan Frankovic.
I think Gaddafi for many years has been very useful to the West as a kind of bogeyman. And they've set him up to be a bogeyman, and then they decided to, you know, basically a lot of these dictators are set up and then knocked down, like Mubarak. We want him when he's there, and then we get rid of him, we throw him away.
Well, Iqbal, what's your take on all this? That you think that the idea of creating Gaddafi as an enemy over the last sort of 20, 30 years?
It's not just the Gaddafi. I think if whoever is following politics find that you can create enemies at any time to incite some kind of animosities or charge people or prepare them to get angry at a certain group of people. This is happening all the time, and we knew about, I mean, Al-Qaddafi was talking about Al-Qaeda the other day and talking about drugs and all that. We all remember that Osama bin Laden was sent to as a friend of the Americans to wherever he is, and he was used at the very beginning to fight the Russians, and they were telling him that those are infidels and you have to, and when they finished with him, now he's their enemy. So any it is possible that people are used to change the course of feelings of a group of people.
Well, Bristol is blessed with migrant communities from many fascinating cultures and parts of the world, and Libya is no exception. Mohamed Al-Haddad has lived here in Bristol for many years, but was born in the Libyan city of Al-Baitha, where the first disturbances took place just over a week ago. I spoke to him earlier this week about the opening stages, as he'd found out from his family, of the Libyan rebellion.
My name is Mohamed. I'm one of the British Libyan citizens in Bristol. I've got my family in the city of Al-Baitha, where the first clashes between the protesters and the police happened on 17th of February 2011. I was told by my brother the second day of the incident that there were a lot of young people who were at the football stadium, and then after they went to drink. After that, they decided to get their friend out of the prison, and they managed to get into a bigger number, where people went together to the prison, and they tried to give an indication that they were visiting people in the prison. And at that time, they managed to get their prisoner out of the prison, and all the prisoners, about 50 people, those prisoners decided to fire their files, 50 prisoners to get out of the prison. Those prisoners have their files at the police station and the court building. They then decided together to go and fire those buildings to get rid of all the document on the evidence on their files, and they succeeded. After that, other religion groups get engaged with them, and they went together to the internal security office to get some guns and army equipment from them. They were not able, because the police officers at that time have received an order to fire the protesters. If we can call them protesters, they are criminals at the beginning. And then a lot of casualties have been lost. And the second day, their relatives protested, and it was the beginning of the protests in Libya.
Okay, and obviously it's spread since then. Can you just give us an idea of what ordinary Libyan people think of Colonel Gaddafi? Because he's not really the same as some of the leaders in Algeria, for example, and in Egypt, is he?
No, he's not the same as Ben Ali or Hosni Mubarak. He has a quite good level of relationship with tribals, and the head of tribals, and also the elderly people in Libya pay him a very good level of respect. He also succeeded to maintain a very good relationship with younger people, and he's quite well respected in Libya. But the situation that those people, you know, abroad from Libya, who have no good relationship with Gaddafi or his regime, they managed to say bad words about him, and they also managed to talk to the West while he was not really welcomed by the West, and raise that negative profile.
Do you think these protests are genuinely inspired by the Libyans, or do you think that the hands of other powers, particularly maybe Israel, United States and Britain, that may be in these protests?
I possibly would doubt something like this, but at the same time, if I just go back and test the level of relationship between Israel and Libya and Israel and Egypt, I would say a very different relationship between both. I remember when we were going to Gaza in my two convoys, this last year and the 2009 convoy, the first convoy and the last convoy, we were very well welcomed in Libya. We entered Libya without visas. we were allowed to access the only capital city in the whole route from Britain to Gaza. We have received donations. We were able to engage with the public in Libya, and that really gave us a very good indication of a security level maintained, at the same time supporting to the needy people of Gaza. Whereas when we went to Egypt, we were surrounded by army, Tunisia the same, Algeria the same, Morocco the same, and not meet any public at all. We were only encouraged to drive in the night time out of the cities, only on the motorway with no other private vehicles on the roads.
So what does that indicate? Is it really spontaneous, or is it being orchestrated from the West?
It can be from the West. What made me think that way is that Gaddafi was not welcomed in the West. He only has been welcomed recently, about after the events of Saddam, about 2004-2003, and then the incident of Lockerbie and Al-Magrahi, he was released in 2009. And then the relationship with the West have been improved incredibly. Also, we've noticed a very good link with leaders as well of the West. And that relationship has influenced the benefit of the Libyan system and the Libyan people internally.
But one of the shocking things is that we've heard on the television here that Colonel Gaddafi has actually used his air force to bomb his own people in Tripoli. This is a pretty shocking thing for him to order, surely.
This is untrue. I was following the news because the source of this news was from Al Jazeera. No one was able to contact the country because of overload calls. But I received messages from a friend of mine from Tunisia to say that this is not right and this is not true. But I did not trust my friend in Tunisia until the second day, which was 21st Monday. I've managed to contact a friend of mine in Tripoli, and he stated to me that army shooting people, ordinary people in the city of Tripoli from flights, from the army fleets, that was not right. This is untrue. This is false information from Al Jazeera. And now that Al Jazeera have been attacked by the Libyan foreign minister and also the public as well, they miss feeding people with wrong information, which could create more war, internal war in Libya. And this is not right. This is not a professional way of publicizing human rights.
What would you like to see as the outcome to all this?
I think I'm in favor of communication, basically, to stop the blood. The son of Gaddafi have offered two methods. The first one is, he said, we are happy to change the flag of the country. We are happy to change the constitution of the country. We are happy to do whatever you want. Just come along and talk to us. But the second scenario was, I'm going to fight for Libya till the last bullet in my pocket, which means blood will be everywhere, which I don't like.
So do you think Gaddafi will be able to continue as the Libyan leader, will be able to command the respect of the people in the country?
I doubt it very much, but temporarily I would advise it to happen. Because what I can see now on the roads and from the Libyan citizen token and the situation in Libya is that he is not now welcomed by the majority of the public, where he was just 2 weeks ago.
What about his son? Do you think his son could take over?
Yeah, I would welcome his son rather than him, to be honest. He is more mature. He understands the needs of the community more than him. He's from our generation. He is not from the older generation. He's been, taught in Britain, and he knows how the human rights has been dealt with. He possibly in a very good relationship with the West as well. And I think, and I thought, that he will be the right person to lead the country temporarily until we get rid of the old-fashioned way of governing the country to a new way.
But he's been talked about, and he was talked about by Margaret Thatcher and others. He was talked about as a mad dog, Gaddafi.
They're talking about the Gaddafi himself, because he never responded, he never said yes to the West when he was younger. But things changed. We all change our mind when we get older. You know, when you have children, you think differently, completely different from you are single. And he has now got not only 7 children and a daughter, he got a country now, so he must think twice before he reacts, particularly to the West. And that's why we've seen the dramatic change of the relationship between Gaddafi and his friends in the West, particularly with Italy, with the state, with the Britain. He has a very good relationship now.
Are you able to point us towards, say, websites or TV channels where we can find out the truth about what's going on in Benghazi and Tripoli?
Nowadays, no, I don't advise you to look anywhere. Just try to communicate directly with people in Libya. Otherwise, or someone who is in touch directly with Libya, and you trust that person, because all the media are listening to or taking information from Al Jazeera, and Al Jazeera is lying and misfeeding information. And she would be sued for this. I'm one of the people who did not like what the Al Jazeera have brought to us in Britain. She made me and my children, my father, my mother, everybody very, very nervous about each other. We cannot communicate with each other, and we only hear a very bad news that really made us terribly live a very terrible life over the last few days.
Born in the Libyan city of Al Baitha, that was Mohammed Al Haddad, who's a resident here of Bristol. Now, that was quite shocking to hear, Martin, that some of the information apparently that's been coming out through Al Jazeera and other TV channels is simply false.
Well, according to Mohammed, I think this is a fog of war situation. As we sit here, for example, I don't know what happened after Friday prayers today in Libya. I haven't looked. So this is a very confusing situation for everybody.
And what about you, Iqbal Tamimi? You're a Palestinian journalist based here in Bristol now. What are your thoughts about how this is all going to go? Because Mohammed there is saying that he really wants Gaddafi to leave now, and possibly maybe his son to take over or somebody else. Do you think that's realistic?
I don't think people would accept his son, because his son is a miniature kind of copy of him. Even though he showed the last couple of years a little bit more sensibility and education, and he contributed to, let's say, he stretched his hand for the West, and he seems to be more understanding and open for other communities. But when I've seen his speech a few days ago, I was shocked. He was really as ruthless and threatening as much as his dad was. So I don't think the Libyans would accept that, especially that even the people in the Arab world and the journalists don't know much about inside Egypt, because of the censorship, the tight censorship, and all the media is controlled by Gaddafi and by his sons. But I can assure you there is a large number of very well educated, capable people in Libya and outside who can run Libya properly. Most of the intellectual Libyans were forced to flee and leave their country and live in the abroad, some of them as refugees and some as asylum seekers or as business people, because they couldn't bear living in their own country in that way, seeing it deteriorating that much. But should he go and leave that responsibility, I can assure you the Libyans are capable of taking care of their country and bring it back to prosperity very, very fast.
Now, well, one thing about Colonel Gaddafi, it looks like he may well be going, but do you think maybe we're going to be missing some sort of humour from him? Is there any positive side
yes.
to him?
Nobody is like him. I mean, he has always shown, he's like the fruits of the summer. Well, he's always humorous, even though he does not show that he intends that to be the case, but this is how he appears to us. At the very beginning, he had a dream of becoming the leader of the Arab world. He did not make it. He wanted to unite Syria and Egypt and Libya, and when he failed, he called himself the king of kings of Africa, and he is playing the role of the leader of all African tribes and he failed in that. He tried to look like Gandhi sometimes, and he took his camel wherever he go to whatever country he was invited to, because he liked its milk, and he would erect his tent wherever he goes. All these strange or bizarre, you know, actions.
Isn't that a sort of traditional thing?
No, it's not
thing?
Traditional. Of course not. Of course not.
It's pantomime.
Of course not. He's wearing police kind of the latest of eyeglasses. Why would he, you know,
you mean the sunglasses?
Yes,
because he's
exactly.
Well known for his sunglasses.
I mean, he had a combination of things. It's like he wanted to look different, shocking. His statements. He wants to leave a controversial feeling wherever he appeared. And I mean, even he had this illusion that he's a good writer. He wrote a book, which is called The Green Book, which even the people who read Arabic, who can understand one page of it, find it extremely strange. And the contents and the way he handled things, as if he thinks he's a philosopher or something.
Now, Martin, you were mentioning this the Gaddafi plot. I mean, the British MI6 apparently actually did try to assassinate him not long ago, didn't they?
According to Annie Mashon and David Shaler, who used to work for MI5, yes. That's why they split from MI5, because they said that the MI6 were... And the most significant thing about this is that MI6 were working with a group called the Islamic Fighting Group. They gave them money in order to carry out an assassination attempt on Gaddafi. There was a bomb in Tripoli which killed some local bystanders but didn't kill Gaddafi. And it was this point where they decided to break with MI5 and to spill the beans.
So are you saying that MI6 were actually working with and paying Al-Qaeda?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Al-Qaeda was set up by the Western intelligence services to fight in Afghanistan, and also they were working with these groups inside Libya to try and get rid of Gaddafi. And people need to understand that Al-Qaeda, basically, most of it is basically a puppet organisation.
Now, Bristol-based Palestinian journalist Iqbal Tamimi, is that something you would agree with? Is Al-Qaeda some creation of the West?
How would I know? it's strange. I mean, the things are very complicated. You hear about things which, you know, does not go through your mind, but there is something that I am suspicious of. I mean, he wouldn't have stayed that long if they didn't want him to stay. I mean, do you think that, for example, USA or whatever leadership in the West, if they are really, really want him out, they can leave him for 30 years? They can't take him off, as they have got rid of, for example, Saddam Hussein. They could have done something, but I think he's amusing, and they like the way he was running his country.
Now, I'm also joined by Lilia Patterson, who's based in Oxford, but she's a researcher who's recently come back from a long 8-month tour of the Middle East, including spending quite a lot of time in Egypt. Lilia, what's your reaction to what you've seen since the new year started of what's been going on over there?
Well, I actually stayed right next to Midan Tahrir, otherwise known as Liberation Square, in downtown Cairo when I was in Cairo. And so it has been quite astounding for me seeing events unfold. But Midan Tahrir is a very big square, and the Mugamba building, where people have been focusing their attention, is also a very large government building. I did, in fact, renew my visa in that building, so I know it very well. And that place, I mean, it's an icon of the heart of Egypt, you know, the heart of Cairo. And so really seeing the way that people have risen up in Cairo, in Midan Tahrir, it's been a symbol of the fact that people really need change. And there are so many different things that are going on in relationship to how people have responded, how people have gathered together, how people, I mean, I've been having photographs sent to me of people cleaning the streets, people gathering together and just really trying to take a pride in their country, whereas up until now they felt very suppressed. But at the same time, I mean, Amnesty International is still reporting that people are being intimidated and they're being tortured even now.
What about other countries? Because you were in Jordan too, and maybe Iqbal, you can chip in here as well. Do you think that this is something which is not finished yet and maybe also going to other countries too?
Well, I think there's two sides to the unrest that has been spreading across the Middle East. And the thing is that obviously what happened in Tunisia was to do with, you know, somebody set fire to himself. I mean, even in Egypt, four people are reported as having set fire to themselves, and that is just because of suffering. You know, people who are poor there, I mean, they really are poor, then they have nothing, and so they are desperate. So that's why people just have this real sense of desperation. So it's a cry for help. But at the same time, there have also been reports in Egypt and also in other countries as well, that there have been, for example, organizations who are being described as being funded by American organizations, where they've been using, they say, democracy organizations in order to promote unrest. And so there's this sense that some people are saying, well, okay, all these bullets that have been fired at us, they all have a Made in USA written on them. And so these dictators have been kind of supported to oppress their own people. And then on the other hand, you have, you know, American organizations that people say maybe are a front for the CIA. And then they're saying, so now they're trying to profit from the fact that they need human rights reform.
Now, Iqbal, is that something you recognise, that the Western powers, particularly the Americans, trying to play both sides here?
It is working, but I think about your comment about Jordan. Jordan is totally different, I think, from the other examples. First of all, there are some reform going on, and the second thing is that they don't have the wealth that Libya had, or maybe Tunisia had, or Egypt had, and it was embezzled or have been misused, that the people will demand a change about it. Of course, the people are demonstrating because they are poor and they need some reforms, but it's not the same extent of, you know, seriousness as it is in Egypt or in Libya.
Now, one of the big questions we're going to close with is, what does this all mean for the situation in the West Bank and Gaza, and for the relationship between Israel and Palestine?
I think USA and Israel are worried about what was going to happen after the Egyptians, the new Egyptian maybe policies will be, whoever would come into control. Would they, for example, ease the blockade on Gaza? Would they treat them differently? A few days ago, they were really making a big fuss about Egypt allowing, for example, two Iranian ships to go through Suez Canal, even though an Israeli ship went through the Suez Canal in 97. And I think everybody's anticipating, just waiting to see what is going to happen. And in general, the people of Gaza are very happy with what happened in Egypt, because Mubarak was part of their torture when they were hungry and they were thirsty and they needed help, and he followed the policies of USA.
And so is the army going to relieve the siege of Gaza, do you think?
It's not going to be that way, but there will be more maybe cooperation in closing maybe the channels and, cooperating openly.
Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Deputy Leader of Bristol City Council, representing the Lib Dems in Clifton East, Simon Cook. To Bristol-based Palestinian journalist Iqbal Tamimi, who was just speaking there, and Oxford researcher Lilia Patterson. Also to our reporter Marina Morris, and of course to old Labour economist Martin Summers. It's our website. If you want to hear the podcast, is www.thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Goodbye, and see you next week. Bristol, and is here to give everybody